Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the March 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. By the weekend, differences between newly re-elected Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Obama administration already reached a point of open hostility without precedent in the history of U.S.-Israeli relations. Then the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that Israel has been spying on the closed-door negotiations between the U.S. and other P5-plus-1 nations and Iran over Tehran's nuclear program almost from day one. According to a report in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, senior White House officials learned that soon after the U.S. and other major powers began talks last year, Israel began secretly listening in. The spying operation was part of a wider campaign by Netanyahu's government to penetrate the negotiations and build a case against the terms of the deal, said current and former U.S. officials whom the paper did not identify. In addition to eavesdropping, Israel reportedly acquired information from confidential U.S. briefings, informants, and diplomatic contacts in Europe. The article cited interviews with more than a dozen current and former diplomats, intelligence officials, policymakers, and lawmakers in the U.S. and Israel. According to the Journal story, the White House discovered the operation when U.S. intelligence agencies, spying on Israel, intercepted communications among Israeli officials that contained details the U.S. believed could have come only from access to the confidential talks. Claiming these were, quote, utterly false allegations, unquote, Israeli officials, quote, denied spying directly on U.S. negotiators, saying they received their information through other means, including close surveillance of Iranian leaders receiving the latest U.S. and European offers. The State of Israel, went on, does not conduct espionage against the United States or Israel's other allies, a senior official in the Prime Minister's office told the Wall Street Journal. The false allegations are clearly intended to undermine the strong ties between the United States and Israel and the security and intelligence relationship we share, end quote. For anyone who believes that, has been listening to this program, I have a handful of bridges to sell them. Israel's espionage reportedly didn't upset the White House as much as it's sharing the information with U.S. lawmakers and others who are trying to sabotage any agreement that would limit Israel's nuclear program without shutting it down entirely. Iran's nuclear program, without shutting it down entirely. It is one thing for the U.S. and Israel to spy on each other, said a senior U.S. official briefed on the matter, but another thing for Israel to steal U.S. secrets and play them back to U.S. legislators to undermine U.S. diplomacy. With less than a week to go before March 31st, the scheduled end of the negotiations, I'll be speaking about all this today with investigative journalist and historian Gareth Porter. Porter has been closely following U.S. and Western efforts to contain Iran for some time, and his recent book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, explores how the current confrontation with Iran and the West came about. That will be at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. Netanyahu's victory in the March 17th Israeli elections was clearly not welcomed by the White House, particularly since it seemed to vindicate Netanyahu's decision to challenge Obama's Iran policy before a joint session of Congress on March 3rd. Not only did President Obama wait for 2 days to congratulate Netanyahu, he publicly objected to the Israeli Prime Minister's declaration that there would be no Palestinian state while he is in office, as well as his Election Day warning to his fellow Jews that Israel's Palestinian Arab population was voting, quote, in droves, end quote, for a new Arab list employing language normally reserved for military operations. After Netanyahu appeared to backtrack on his opposition to a Palestinian state following his victory and apologized to Israel's Arab voters, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, when asked why the president did not take the prime minister at his word about his support for two-state solution, quickly replied, well, I guess the question is, which one? Said Earnest, quote, the divergent comments of the prime minister legitimately call into question his commitment to this policy principle and his lack of commitment to what has been the foundation of our policy making in the region. End quote. The question remains, what will the U.S. do about it? It has been made clear that the annual gift of $3 billion to Israel in military assistance is untouchable. But the larger question is whether the U.S. will continue vetoing U.N. Security Council resolutions condemning Israel for violating international law and expanding its settlements. On CNN this past Sunday, Senator John McCain made a most remarkable comment regarding the dispute between Israel and the U.S., in which he projected his own ineptitude, but also said something about American politics, which most of the news sources that ran the story left out. When asked by a host, Gloria Borger, quote, "Are we at a dangerous point here in relation between U.S. and Israel?" McCain responded, "Well, I think that's up to the President of the United States. Look, there was a free and fair democratic election, the only nation in the region that will have such a thing. The president should get over it. Get over your temper tantrum, Mr. President. It's time we work together with our Israeli friends in trying to stem this tide of ISIS and Iranian movement throughout the region, which is threatening the very fabric of the region." End quote. That Iran is doing more to stem the tide of ISIS is something that apparently has not occurred to the man who chose Sarah Palin as his running mate. "Well, the least of your problems," said McCain, as if he was addressing Obama, "is what Bibi Netanyahu said during an election campaign," end quote. And here is the line that the mainstream media decided not to print. Quote, "If every politician were held to everything they say in a political campaign," said McCain, "obviously that would be a topic of long discussion," end quote. For a more informed interpretation of the Israeli election, I will quote from Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy, who travels with a bodyguard given the death threats he has received in that democratic country from his fellow Israelis for his criticism of their government. Quote, "The first conclusion that arose just minutes after the announcement of the exit poll was particularly discouraging," he wrote. "The nation must be replaced. Not another election for the country's leadership, but general elections to choose a new Israeli people, immediately. The country urgently needs that. It won't be able to stand another term for Benjamin Netanyahu. If after 6 years of nothing, after 6 years of sowing fear and anxiety, hatred and despair, this is the nation's choice, then it is very ill indeed. If after everything that has been revealed in recent months," writes Levy, "if after everything that's been written and said, if after all this, the Israeli phoenix succeeded in rising from the ashes and getting reelected, if after all this the Israeli people chose him to lead for another 4 years, something is truly broken, possibly beyond repair." Said Levy, "Netanyahu deserves the Israeli people, and they deserve him. The results are indicative of the direction the country is headed," he said. "A significant proportion of Israelis has finally grown detached from reality. This is the result of years' worth of brainwashing and incitement. These Israelis voted for the man who will lead the United States to adopt harsh measures against Israel." Well, we'll see about that. "For the man whom the world long ago grew sick of." True. Quote, "They voted for the man who admitted to having duped half the world during his Bar-Ilan speech, where he voiced support for a Palestinian state. And now he has torn off his mask and disavowed those words once and for all. Israel said yes to the man who said no to a Palestinian state. Dear Likud voters, what the hell do you say yes to?" asked Gideon Levy. "Another 50 years of occupation and ostracism? Do you really believe in that?" That was Gideon Levy, just after the Israeli election. But in his past Sunday's column, he expressed some other thoughts. Under the headline, "Netanyahu will be remembered for speaking Israel's truth," Gideon Levy wrote, quote, "I would like to say thank you to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Thank you for telling the truth. Last week you were revealed as the first Israeli prime minister to tell the truth. For at least 25 years, most Israeli statesmen have been lying, misleading the world, the Israelis, and themselves, until Netanyahu arose, he of all statesmen, and told the truth. If only this truth had been told by an Israeli prime minister 25 years ago, maybe even 50 years ago, when the occupation was born. Still, better late than never. The public rewarded him for this truth, and Netanyahu was elected for a fourth term." Gideon Levy goes on. "Netanyahu said last week that if he were to be reelected, a Palestinian state would not be established on his watch. Plain and simple, loud and clear. This simple, pure truth was the case for all his predecessors as well. All the prime ministers, peace lovers, and justice seekers from the center and the left who gave false promises. But who thought to admit it before him? Who had the courage to reveal the truth?" asked Gideon Levy. Well, the latest of these deceivers was Zionist Union leader Yitzhak Herzog, who has just been defeated. Herzog's daring plan included 5 years of negotiations. The public rewarded him for that, end quote. And that was in Gideon Levy's column in Sunday's Haaretz. Levy's a former guest of mine on Takes on the World, and I'm looking forward to meeting and appearing with him and today's guest, Gareth Porter, on a program at the National Press Club in Washington on April 10th that poses the question, is the Israel lobby good for the United States? Is it good for Israel? Well, you can guess our answers, although I will suggest that were it not for the power of the Israel lobby, that part of the world would quite likely look very different than it does today. Regarding Iran, the Republican-controlled Senate, which, like the rest of the party, makes no secret of its preference for Netanyahu over their own president, will be continuing its war on the White House and push for a confrontation with Iran when Congress returns from its spring break in mid-April. That's when the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will vote on a bill allowing Congress to weigh in on any Iran deal 2 weeks after the deadline U.S. and the P5 plus one neighbor negotiators face for reaching an agreement with Tehran. Committee Chairman Tennessee Republican Bob Corker and Ranking Democrat Robert Menendez from New Jersey, currently under indictment and one of Congress's leading recipients of pro-Israel payoffs, contributions, said Thursday that the committee will vote on the legislation on April 14th. The bill, which he has promised to veto, would require President Obama to submit any deal on Iran's nuclear program to the Israeli-occupied Congress for review. The president also wouldn't be able to lift sanctions against Iran for roughly 2 months while Congress debated the bill. Quote, we, quote, from the senators who signed this, who are pushing this legislation, quote, we have been working together very closely to ensure that we have the strongest vote possible on the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, and to achieve that result, we have agreed to a markup of the bill in the Foreign Relations Committee as soon as we return on Tuesday, April 14th. Al Corker had expressed for a vote before the March 31st deadline when negotiators faced for reaching the framework for a comprehensive deal that would lift the sanctions on Iran in exchange for Iran agreeing to give up any pursuit of nuclear weapons. But after 47 senators sent an open letter to Iran promising to negate any deal with Tehran approved by Obama after he leaves office, Menendez and other Democrats who backed the legislation felt obliged to support the administration in delaying the vote. As of yesterday, 318,300 Americans have petitioned the White House to try the 47 senators under the Logan Act, a 1799 law which, quote, makes it a crime for citizens to engage, quote, in any correspondence or intercourse with any foreign government with intent to influence the measures or conduct of any foreign government in relation to any disputes or controversies with the United States, end quote. Violation of the Logan Act is a felony, punishable under federal law with imprisonment of up to 3 years. The chances of these 47 traitors being prosecuted, however, are nil. The text of the law is sufficiently vague, and there has not only never been a conviction under the Act, the last indictment was in 1803. One might argue, however, that never in our history have so many legislators openly sold themselves to become agents of a foreign government. The White House has urged lawmakers not to pass legislation before June 30th, the deadline for finalizing a deal. While Congress is on its break, House Speaker John Boehner will be rushing off to Israel to get his marching orders from the man he considers his president, Benjamin Netanyahu. It was Boehner, in cahoots with Israel's ambassador to the U.S., American Jewish turncoat Ron Dermer, who arranged Netanyahu's speech to Congress without notifying the White House. Short of being arrested for treason, Boehner obviously needs to be placed on the no-fly list. While preparing for this program, I found something curious and thought I'd share it with you. On March 11th, the morning of my last program, while driving to the station, I was pleasantly surprised to hear John Hockenberry interviewing veteran Washington Post journalist Walter Pincus on The Takeaway about Israel's nuclear weapons program, which is heretofore not mentioned in the mainstream media. And I was looking forward to playing a selection of that conversation for you today. It was unfortunately not to be. That segment toward the end of the takeaway, has been scrubbed from that day's archives. Why that happened, I could safely guess. What Pincus, who was around at the time, described was Israel's pattern of deception in developing its nuclear weapons program against the wishes of President Kennedy, and doing so by employing the very same trickery that it accuses Iran of doing today, a fact that Hockenberry acknowledged. I would guess that Hockenberry heard very quickly from more than one Israel firster in the American Jewish establishment that saying such things on our public radio airwaves was beyond the pale, and so the segment was removed. Only the headline remains when one does an internet search, quote, "How Israel Blazed the Trail for Iran's Nuclear Program," unquote. When one clicks on the link, the message is, "Page not found." And when one plays the program's archives through March 11, it's not there. Well, someone who has been noticed to be silent on the widening gap between the White House and Tel Aviv is Hillary Clinton, who is expected to be the Democratic Party's presidential candidate in 2016. As if she hasn't had enough problems with her emails, Clinton is arguably more beholden to the Israel lobby than any candidate of either party who will have preceded her. Not only has Hubby Bill's foundation received more than $10 million from Israeli-American communications millionaire Haim Saban, and given a seat on the foundation board to Saban's wife, Cheryl Saban, but 2 years ago, speaking at the Saban Forum of the Brookings Institution, in a clip I played here on Takes on the World, she proudly acknowledged being one, quote, "one of Haim's Power Rangers," end quote. If that's confusing to you adults, you should know that Saban made his first millions on buying and syndicating the Japanese children's program, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. In July of last year, when asked in a Bloomberg TV interview what kind of financial commitment he was ready to make to get Hillary elected president should she decide to run, Saban indicated he was prepared to contribute, quote, "as much as needed," end quote. In an interview in The New Yorker in 2010, which you can read online, it's called The Influencer, Saban admitted to being a one-issue man, and that his issue was Israel. With Sheldon Adelson expected to spend millions in electing his choice for Republicans' presidential candidacy, based on what that person can do for Israel, and Saban preparing to do the same for Madam Clinton, the prospects for 2016 America and the world are the most depressing yet. Politics is not a game for kids.